Nothing in this program should be considered investment advice. It is for educational purposes only. Please hit pause and read this disclaimer in full.
The average investor that's purchased these things is going to have a stock market that's going to collapse dramatically and a bond market that's going to collapse dramatically, and they're not going to have that hedge in place that they were expecting to, and they're going to be forced to sell something at some point in the future if they don't have a risk-managed adaptive overlay over the top of it. And that's going to ripple through the housing market. It's going to ripple through every section of our economy. And this hindsight bias that we have and looking back over the past 10 years of how the government's been able to bail everything out and we're mentally projecting in the future is going to be a completely different reality than what most people are imagining.
The following is the audio version of a video released at peakprosperity.com. Visit peakprosperity.com to watch the video and to find other insightful content such as articles, discussion forums, and exclusive subscriber-only content.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this episode of Finance U. I'm your host, Chris Martinson, back with Paul Kiker of Kiker Wealth Management. How are you doing today, Paul?
I'm doing good. Happy Wednesday to you, Chris. Good to see you again.
Happy Wednesday. We are recording this on Wednesday. It looks like it's April 29th. We have a lot to discuss today, Paul, and we're going to begin with this, if we can. I'm talking about the Iran war, of course, but oil and gasoline prices are finally on the rise again. We'll get to that data in just a second, but this is how the Wall Street Journal, this is the main talking point they're spinning right now, which is that they say here, quote, talks between the U.S. and Iran have stalled, certainly have. American officials are betting that Iran will soon crack because of the deepening economic crisis. Iran is betting the U.S. will crack first and end its blockade of Iranian ports to calm global markets and bring down American gasoline prices, which are on the rise today. They say here, however, but authorities are confronting a level of hardship not seen in decades, according to Iranian residents who will go unnamed. And they say as well, as the money dries up because of the blockade, we may find more and more folks have no choice but to mobilize politically. So that Paul, is the hope here. They say here, you know, subheadline, Iranians feel the pain as their economy descends into a death spiral. That's a pretty strong piece of language for what's not an editorial. This is actually just an article. But that's the story right now. Iranians are going to buckle because of the economic pressure. And that's really the story they're running with right now officially. But what if the Iranians don't buckle? What if they're more committed than that? We could easily see the Strait of Hormuz remain closed for another month, 2 months, 3 months. The economic pain to the rest of the world is going to be extraordinary if that happens. But what do you think about this approach?
I think it's really interesting, especially with all the headlines coming out about the oil shut-ins, and that's going to destroy their production capabilities forever. And that's the biggest reason that they're, you know, the U.S. has the upper hand. Now, I've tried to learn as much as I can. I know you know that, so you can update everybody as far as what the ramifications of the oil shut-ins and top-offs and how they'll lose production. There's differing beliefs on the timeline to reach that from what I understand. But I kind of look at it from an equity market standpoint. The equity markets have gone with the speculation. I guess it's in line with what was it Trump said a couple of days ago, you know, the world is a casino. The markets seem to be acting like a casino and placing their bets at this point, that there's no way that we're going to have this continue, that somebody's not going to let it happen. Iran's not going to be in a situation to where those shut-ins would occur. And if this does occur much longer, right, whether it's further time before they have to reach that shut-in, or they don't care, right, because they want the economic impact to ripple across the world, we're going to have some massive compounding effects in the markets economically if we reach that standpoint. The longer this goes on, the much greater the damage is going to be, and I believe that it sets up for a potential vacuum to the downside in the markets. I do.
After the JCPOA collapse happened, and also in the context of COVID, Iran's oil production got totally shut in for a 3 or 4 months, like was completely shut in. And it, you know, I don't know what damage happened to the reservoirs, but they survived that. They've survived a lot of things. So I'm just a little worried that we seem to be having this hope is a terrible strategy, right? For portfolios, but I think also for politics. And maybe they're just giving us one story, but out here, it looks that's a hope. We're going to hope that the Iranians rise up against their you know, overlords. We're going to hope that, you know, the pain that they're experiencing causes this thing we want to have happen. The more direct thing would be to say, they need some things, we need some things, we're going to have to negotiate, we won't get everything we want, maybe they don't get everything they want, but that's how you go forward. Right now, when they say the talks have stalled, the U.S. has 15 things we want and we won't budge on, and they have 5 or 7 things now that they won't budge on, and none of them match, right?
No.
So we're not really at the negotiating stage yet, I don't think. You know, that negotiations happen when you start to pull things off of your list and they modify things on their list and pull things off, and then you come up with an agreed upon set of things.
And we reach that compromise. And the problem is, the U.S. is at least acting like we hold all the cards, that we can control this or wipe them out or do whatever, and that they're going to crack. And, you know, there are unfortunately times where the underdog just refuses to give up. I mean, my grandfather came through the Great Depression. I remember him telling me one time, he said, son, he said, if you get knocked down, keep getting up. If you're getting beat so hard while you're knocked down, as long as you can keep your nose out of the dirt or the water, keep fighting. And that's, you know, when you have these economies that, and these countries where especially those leaders don't want to give up their power, you know, that's my concern, is that they're like, okay, fine, we'll burn the world down if you're before we're gonna give in and not have some compromise here. And the U.S. seems like they won't do that, so we're at a standstill. And there's a lot of, and the markets seem to be speculating that they're gonna cave in. I don't know if they will or not, but at this point, they sure haven't.
Nope, sure haven't. And accompanying that, yesterday, we found out also from the Wall Street Journal that President Trump has instructed aides to prepare for an extended blockade of Iran, targeting the regime's coffers, its bank accounts, in a high-risk bid to compel a nuclear capitulation Tehran has long refused. Not totally accurate. Tehran did sign a document, a nuclear document, and that got torn up by Trump. So,
okay.
That was yesterday. This is today. It's so hard keeping up with Donald Trump. He tweets out today, Iran can't get their act together. They don't know how to sign a non-nuclear deal. Don't know what he means by that. They better get smart soon. No more Mr. Nice Guy. With an AI picture of him holding a battle rifle, I guess. Things blowing up in the background that looks like Iran. So very hard to sort of get a sense of what's actually going on here. I don't know. Usually markets don't like uncertainty. They seem to have liked it a lot lately. We can talk about that in a minute. But this is the reaction now. Paul, we have a brand new closing high here on April 29th, 2026 for Brent. You can see it was a little bit higher at a couple of points here, but it spiked and came right back down, just got smacked. So it's at 116.82 a barrel on this chart. The day is not over yet, so we'll see where it actually closes. But that would be a new high for this move. And then secondarily, we have a brand new closing high on gasoline here in the United States. So that's interesting. And I just want it. So it's 355 here on this chart. Normally, you have to add about a dollar on top of that to get your pump price. That's good rule of thumb. So it'd be about 455 nationally average. It's going to be higher in Chicago and California and some other blue locations for reasons. But then I just want to point out something. So here we're now looking at a chart that goes back 20 years for gasoline in the U.S. And the first thing we're going to notice is it hit this same level we're at today back in 2008. Paul, I consider that spike in energy prices, gasoline prices back then, to have been a pin that helped to prick the housing bubble back then. It was another stress on already stressed consumers who'd reached too far with real estate and all of that. And then we had the 2022 spike here. You remember, you're old enough like me to remember 2022. Stocks and bonds both took it. A very historically unusual move in the markets to see both stocks and bonds take it in the shorts. Both hemorrhaged badly in 2022. Again, because energy is an unavoidable stressor to the system. You can't print your way around it. There's nothing you can do. It just hurts. And here we are today, pretty much, you know, in the same territory. So if we have an extended blockade, and if it turns out gasoline prices go higher, it's easy to predict what happens next. We're gonna see a lot of economic stress in the U.S. And they just reported a couple hours ago, at the time of this recording here on Wednesday, the 29th, that U.S. gas prices hit a fresh record, rising to nationwide average of $4.23 per gallon. My prediction is, well, we're going to set fresh gasoline price records every week for months until that strait opens back up again.
It sure appears to be that way. You know, and going back to that 2022 when you had bonds and stocks go down, if I remember correctly, that was the worst performance for bonds and stocks combined in 40 years. And I fully believe, and I had told clients I was working with at the time, I believe that that is a birth pain or a warning or a type and shadow of what we're going to see in the future again. And not knowing what was going to cause that, but you're already starting to see Australian bonds have already breached the 5% level. Rates are starting to climb already where, you know, they're in control, but they seem to be sniffing out something completely different than what the equity markets do. So, you know, what are you going to do if you're in a passive 60-40 portfolio and you've got equities that go down 30 or 40 or 50% and you have bonds that go down 20, 30 or 40 or 50%. You're not going to have that counterbalance that people have relied upon throughout history in their mathematic modeling, because this is a completely different environment we find ourselves in.
Yeah.
It's going to be a train wreck if this continues.
Well, it will. And Paul, we're going to take a quick break, but when we come back, I want to talk about why I'm positive we're going to be seeing much higher gasoline prices going forward, unless something really dramatic happens. We'll be right back. Today's markets are more volatile than ever. With ongoing economic and geopolitical uncertainty, navigating such environments requires thoughtful, adaptive strategies, not a one-size-fits-all approach. At Peak Financial Investing, our registered investment advisory firm connects clients with experienced wealth managers who focus on active portfolio management. These professionals use evidence-based strategies designed to respond to changing conditions, not outdated formulas, but customized approaches grounded in research, discipline, and risk awareness. We believe in open, informed conversations, including discussing tools like precious metals and diversification as part of a broader financial strategy. Every investor's situation is unique, and our advisors tailor their guidance accordingly. Visit peakfinancialinvesting.com today to schedule your free consultation and explore how proactive management can support your financial goals. I'm Dr. Chris Martinson, proud to work with Peak Financial Investing, and my support reflects my professional views. I encourage you to take control of your financial future by making informed decisions. Welcome back, everybody. So, Paul, here, we got to talk about this. First, there was this dramatic fight for $100 in the United States. I have my suspicions about who was trying to cap the price at $100. It's a big round number. But this was just yesterday, April 28th, today being the 29th at the time of this recording. And you could see here, oil, this is the $100 mark line right there. It poked its head up. It's 7 in the morning and started to spike up almost 102. Then, bang, got smashed back under 100, over 100, under 100, over 100. Under, over, under, over, under, capped, over, under. There was this huge battle. they just tried so hard, and now it's breached that. It's closing in 104 at this point. It's got a lot higher to go, as far as I'm concerned. Mm-hmm. And this has just been oil traders, people who've been in the business 30, 40 years, finally coming around to the idea of going, someone sure seems to be selling a lot of oil at key moments, and key round numbers. It's just, I don't think we have fair markets right now.
I've actually been shocked by the individuals that I've followed, the analysts over the years, that have absolutely refused. Maybe they'll hint around the edges that there's a hidden hand out there every now and then, but they've never just outright said, you know, clearly in their reports that there was that hidden hand that was influencing the markets. And there's been a lot of discussion about that here recently. And what's interesting is that's a major battle. That's really important. We had talked several years ago about gold's major breakout from resistance, and that was just technical, kind of emotional thing, and then the follow-on that we've seen in price on the other side. When you have a breakout of a major battle line like that, you've got people that are short at that level that have to cover their shorts, and then you're going to have other strategies that are going to pile on that trade. I mean, and a lot of times we have to have confirmation that that battle line is broken. Because if that battle is successful and the sellers take over, then you're going to see a collapse in that price. The stronger the battle, the greater the move is either way. So the fact that we've broken out above that right now, you're going to have a lot of momentum traders that are going to come in behind that as well, which will further exacerbate the upside price potential. And this could get pretty ugly, quite frankly.
One of the problems, Paul, which we've discussed a lot, but it can't be repeated too often, is that in an actual market, prices are what set a clearing function between supply and demand. So if you have a supply problem and you're trying to keep prices down, you're going to have demand that's just too high given the circumstances. And so I've talked about this, and yes, there'll be traders with momentum. There's going to be a lot of technical reasons why money's going to come and go. But I want to talk fundamentally. The prediction was easy to make. I made it weeks ago right here on this program and other places. And I said, look, if the United States holds oil and oil products down low, the rest of the world's going to like sidle right up, fill up ships, and sail away with it. And so we just got our first read for this past week. API reports their best guess at oil inventories right before the EIA does. And they reported that crude is down 1.8 million barrels. The SPR released 7.1 million barrels, a million barrels a day, out of our strategic petroleum reserve, or as I like to call it, our strategic political reserve. It's being released and sent to the rest of the world. And gasoline down 8.5 million barrels. That is the largest weekly draw of gasoline since this 2021. We had this big storm, this winter storm, that closed the refineries down for a minute or two. And also distillates, which is jet fuel and diesel, down 2.6 million barrels. These are big draws. Our inventories are being drained, both of crude and products, because we kept the price low and people said, yeah, we'll take that. Let's go. This only goes on so long before we see corresponding price increases, because when your inventories go down, your prices go up. So I'm suggesting that what we need to do is let markets set the price so that supply and demand actually balance each other out. It won't be fun, but it's the only way to make these things actually work and not break.
Yeah. And we had talked about using the analogy of being able to slow your car, you know, without hitting a wall running at a speed, right? You talked about that. Falling from a building, you hit a stop. The market has to be able to adjust to that. It's going to have much more of a violent reaction. Another bit that I've thought was very interesting, I was reading an article this morning. People are watching the Chinese strategic petroleum reserves very closely to see what they're pulling down. And on the last report that I read, they've not even tapped theirs yet at this point. So they're truly keeping those as an emergency reserve on the side, and they have tons of reserves. So I think they're humble in their approach. They're being strategic. They're being prudent. Where in the U.S., it seems our arrogance has led us to believe that, hey, we're gonna paper this over. We're going to pull out of our strategic reserves to help us politically, to make everybody feel really good here in the short run for polling or whatever that reason is. And we're just putting ourselves in a weaker and weaker and weaker circumstance. It's like when I run across somebody that has no savings whatsoever and they're living paycheck to paycheck, not out of necessity, but out of choice, right? They're wanting to live this lifestyle higher than they can live, and their lifestyle is fragile. Any economic hiccup can cause them to come apart. That's my greatest concern about the fact that we keep drawing these strategic petroleum reserves down, because that's our emergency savings as a country to keep things moving.
Yep. So I guess the summary of this section is Look, oil and gas prices are now moving up finally in the U.S. and Atlantic Basin markets. Prediction is they're going to move up a lot more because why? Well, the Strait is still closed down, and it doesn't look like the two parties have anything remotely close to what we would call a ceasefire agreement ready list of things that they can more or less agree on, and the clock is ticking. We think in the United States, apparently, that the clock is ticking faster for Iran. They think it's ticking faster for us. I think both sides are just going to play a game of chicken here, and we'll see. But I'll bet you, Paul, $5 a gallon national average gasoline is our pain threshold in this story.
I can see that very clearly, and I'm not taking the other side of that bet. I bet with you.
Yeah. All right, Paul, I want to turn now to another section of thinking, which is about the inflation. Inflation inbound. We've talked about this before. It too bears repeating. It's this important. Remember, we had this bad period of inflation, the worst our country had experienced, 73 to 76, and then, oh no, a double hump, which went from 78 to 82. So that double hump inflation, it doesn't just sort of rhyme. It's almost a full repetition. Again, this was an energy crisis, money printing decisions. We're going to look at that data. We have both of those elements back in play here today. But the question would be, somebody posed it to me, look, if the double hump inflation of the late 70s to early 80s peaked out at about 14% on a year-over-year basis, where do you think we're going this time? This is different in the sense, Paul, that this is a supply shock. It's larger than anything else. We don't have any historical analogs where we can sort of say it was kind of like that. It's just both in terms of its suddenness and its magnitude, just without precedent. Okay. My best, Paul, I will not be surprised to see over the next 2 to 3 years that we go up to high double-digit inflation. I'm talking 18 to 20%. That would not shock me if we track along with this. And nobody's ready for that.
No, I mean, the destruction that's going to cause across the board, it appears that a lot of the corporations were much wiser than the U.S. government, Treasury secretaries in the past, because what we have seen, they seem to have termed their debt out for much longer, 20 and 30 years, and took advantage of those lower rates. So maybe a lot of the corporations will kind of be okay in that situation. But the problem is they've sold a lot of those bonds to investors that may necessarily need that capital. Investors that have expected, okay, if stocks go down, bonds are going to go up. So if I need some liquidity to keep from being forced to sell my passive investments, at the worst time, I'll sell those bonds. If we get that type of inflation, the average investor that's purchased these things is going to have a stock market that's going to collapse dramatically and a bond market that's going to collapse dramatically, and they're not going to have that hedge in place that they were expecting to, and they're going to be forced to sell something at some point in the future if they don't have a risk-managed adaptive overlay over the top of it. It's just inevitable if we get there. And that's going to ripple through the housing market. It's going to ripple through every section of our economy. And this hindsight bias that we have and looking back over the past 10 years of how the government's been able to bail everything out and we're mentally projecting in the future is going to be a completely different reality than what most people are imagining.
Yeah, I've got some data on that, too, we can discuss. But if we imagine, okay, if we do repeat this double hump inflation, obviously that's everybody needs to begin preparing for that right now. Because what do we know about inflation when it comes? If you're on a fixed income, your COLA adjustments never are as fast as the actual inflation you're experiencing, right? So you got to look ahead to that and do the best you can, I think, to create some buffer in that or understand that you may have to really go further in terms of scrimping, and saving to get through that period of time. As well, what investments do well and do poorly, I think passive investors are going to experience this as a very rough ride. Because if you're passively in a standard 60-40 portfolio, well, the 40 part is going to get mauled by this. Absolutely mauled. Remember, in the 70s, they called U.S. Treasury bonds certificates of confiscation. Meaning if you held them, you were just losing money. Because you might have held a bond that was yielding 5%, and all of a sudden there's an equivalent bond on the market yielding 14%. You have a huge drawdown in your capital on that if you choose to redeem it. So,
yes, a huge drawdown, and that's going to be painful. And the investing environment completely changes right? I mean, and the interesting thing about passive, it's robotic, right? It doesn't care about price. It doesn't care about inflation expectations. It doesn't care about anything outside of the fact that I've got money in and I'm putting it to work. It's not going to make any type of adaptation. So the strength of that passive is, if things are irrational, you're going to do exactly what the general market's going to do, because it's irrational and it has no management or adaptation for that. If it's irrational, right, because if we get that type of environment, markets are going to sell off and they're going to go below where they should be, then you're going to stay in that environment for as long as, you know, with no adaptation. And you've just got to hope and hopefully you have prepared ahead to make sure you've got liquidity so that you're not forced to sell at the worst time.
Absolutely. So if we think about this, how would we possibly get to that crazy 18, 20% inflation reading? Well, one is we just keep this war up for a while. Charlie Bilello just posted this morning. Since the start of the Iran war, jet fuel plus 70%, sulfur plus 60%, Brent crude plus 52%, heating oil plus 52%, WTI, that's West Texas Intermediate U.S. crude oil, plus 48%, urea, an important nitrogenous fertilizer for corn production and other crops, 48%, diesel plus 45%, gasoline plus 40%, European natural gas up 36%, fertilizers generally 23%, and so on, with some softs down there, palm oil, wheat starting to poke their little heads up. And so that's how you get to those high double-digit inflation, because, Paul, all that stuff, the oil that's in there, that feeds into everything. It's just not possible to have 50, and listen, if this goes on long enough, these numbers are going to turn into triple-digit numbers. There's going to be 100% increases, 200% increases. Those will feed into high double-digit inflation no matter what we do. So this has to end soon. And I guess our hope is Iran's going to fold first, and they're hoping we're going to fold first. But this is getting pretty dodgy.
And I'm just amazed that the market's not taking any of this into consideration, any of that risk off the sidelines. Yes, we've had a technical move up. There were squeezes, short covering, all of that stuff. But I mean, if you just look at the general equity environment out there, they're ignoring what's taking place in the Middle East. It's all, you know, the fact that we've broken out to all-time highs after consolidating for a period. That is important. But it's important if we're in the same type of environment without exterior risks that have increased. Risks have increased dramatically, and it's easy to say how this can unfold worst-case scenario, and you're having to embrace a lot of speculation and hope to assume that this is going to be over without any continued damage at this point. And my question is, Ryan, if Iran wants to cause as much damage as possible, then they want to drag this out as long as possible, right? And you know, my question is if China's in the background, you know, we've heard that they're providing some support, at least in intelligence gathering that they're sharing with Iran. So are they protecting their strategic petroleum reserves because they're in the background saying, hey, you know, let's deliver an economic blow to the U.S. And if Iran has some hidden support back there that's encouraging them to not negotiate, this really could get out of hand pretty quickly. And I'm just thinking out loud, not saying that's the case.
Well, China just announced yesterday that they're going to resume exporting certain petroleum products. I believe diesel was on the list, gasoline was on the list, and maybe naphtha, but I can't remember. But diesel and gasoline were on the list. Oh, it was jet fuel. That was the third one. That means they have an abundance of those products right now. And so I have to start to wonder, Paul, if it isn't true that some of those Iranian tankers have come out and they've been going to China anyway. Right. Because when China says they're going to resume exports of those products, it means they have more of those than they currently need. That's not a deficit. That's a surplus situation. Right. So the question is, if their reserves aren't going down, where's that oil coming from? I'm beginning to suspect there's more of a leak in the strait than we've been told.
Right. Maybe all of the ships that are coming out are going straight over there. We're just not being told that.
Yep. Or Russia has found a way to begin to sneak stuff over to China. So speaking of urea, the food inflation, this is going to be a really big thing. Obviously, you know, from the outside in concept, the weaker countries are going to get hit hardest. You know, this is absolutely a truth at this point in time. And the urea prices, again, which is a nitrogen fertilizer, now we're looking at the World Nitrogen Index here and Middle East Arab Gulf area compared to New Orleans. New Orleans is up 75%-ish, but these other ones are closing in on 100% increases since the start of the war. That's an extraordinarily large problem for these countries that are Myanmar, Burma, Bangladesh, India. You know, it's this is coming, and it's going to really spike world food prices. And of course, remember the Arab Spring 2011. Yeah, there was this Tunisian fruit vendor set himself on fire. That was the spark. But actually, the dry tinder was how much bread prices had gone up. And this was, again, in consequence of rapidly rising food prices in early 2011. So high food costs tend to lead to social unrest, particularly in the developing countries. It's a pattern.
Yeah, and with that input cost and farmers choosing not to put that fertilizer down, even in a normal environment, you get lower yields. God forbid we have a drought that comes on top of that in different parts of the world. That's just going to further supercharge the food price increases, and that's going to cause a lot of damage to a lot of the world.
Well, allegedly, it's going to be another, not just a strong, but maybe a record-breaking-ish kind of an El Nino year this year. And that just messes up rainfall patterns all over the place, which tends to mess up your growing patterns all over the place. So if that happens, we could see vastly higher food prices. So headline this morning on Bloomberg, like, wheat prices highest since 2023. And I'm like, I don't think they've really budged that much. So I took a look at this, Paul. Sure enough, yep, there's wheat. Tucked it up right there. You have to go back to... Well, I guess that's 2024, by the way. I count things. But can we talk about that 2022 moment again? That's where wheat was right there.
Oh, yeah.
More than double from here. So obviously, it could really run hard and still have a hard time getting to those 2022 levels. Again, this is all in the context of the Russia's war with Ukraine. And the world just became worried that this was going to disrupt certain energy market things, and it did to some extent, but this is hardly, this is such a muted response, I struggle to understand how it's been this muted.
That doesn't make sense with the risks that are on the horizon. There doesn't seem to be any anticipation of that coming to reality. The assumption is Trump's going to taco, assuming that he can, betting that he can, and that this is going to be over because we've got the midterms coming up and how damaging that would be.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the common theme I hear across the board of every investor, every analyst, that's especially modern portfolio theory, is just this full belief that there's no way Trump's going to allow this to unfold the way it looks like it potentially can. You know, and I keep asking the question, well, do you think he has that much control? Nobody can answer that question clearly. It's like, no, there's no way. He's got something that he'll pull off. Well, the problem is, if this continues, you can't print money into an inflationary environment. That's just adding gasoline to the fire. That's going to make the situation far worse. So this is a pretty tedious situation that we find ourselves in.
Which is kind of interesting because Tavi Costa writing here that agricultural commodities are now breaking out decisively from a nearly 20-year resistance, just as expected. When energy moves, food prices tend to follow. This is deeply concerning for society, yet it aligns with a broader macro trend. People will point to isolated narratives like droughts, but that misses the bigger picture. This is a second-order effect of the energy issue, and then he's got a Substack about all of this, and here's the chart he put along with that. You can clearly see this resistance line here goes back 20 years, and oh, this is the first time that agricultural commodities have sort of poked their little head above that trend line. Yeah, they could poke their head back down again, but I can't see it at this point. Seems pretty clear to me that
no,
this is a beginning of a new trend of some kind.
Well, and those trend breaches that have been in place for so long, those are ridiculously important. You know, and all of the 28 years that I've been doing this and studying trend lines and breaks and resistance and all that, nobody can really explain exactly why that is, right? But it occurs. And that makes me think, if I can find it here real quick, going back to looking at interest rates when we broke that major downtrend. Let me see if I can find that real quick, because it shows a good example of what is most likely to follow through when you have those trend breaks, because it's a regime change. And it's not something that changed overnight. I mean, there were a lot of investors out there. They've kind of given up on it to begin with. There's still hope. But what this is the 30-year Treasury yield. Of course, that spiked here, 1981 at around 15% on this chart. But that was a clear trend that was in place. And every time interest rates hit that trend line, poof, they went lower. And then we finally reached the bottom side of this trend line and we break out. And what has occurred since then? We've continued to rise, right? So maybe you pull back some if we have an economic recession, but it's clear with the weight of the evidence, this is a completely different environment. It looks like we're cycling higher, even without all of these pressures that we're discussing that are just going to exacerbate that move over time. So this is just puts in perspective that we very well could see a major trend change with those agricultural commodities breaching that trend line that's been in place for so long.
Mm-hmm. Well, so there's two reasons that prices rise. One is when you have a supply shock, right? So we have less oil, less natural gas, so there's less fertilizer, so there's a lower crop yield. That less supply will of course, turn into higher prices. The second reason, of course, is money printing. And if you can we talk about this? Because this has been on my mind. This is part of the inflation story. So the Federal Reserve has clearly started to change its behavior. You can see this is its Federal Reserve balance sheet. So when the Fed's balance sheet goes up and expands, what it's doing is it's going out and buying some sort of a debt product with money. It's printed out of thin air, right? So it buys treasuries, formerly mortgage-backed securities, little Bear Stearns funds, some corporates, whatever they felt they had to do. And so that doesn't look like much, but we're looking at this over a 20-year period. Let's dial in. This is what it looks like here. In the first 4 months of 2026, it is printed now $172 billion, annualizes out to $500 billion per year. And the Fed is printing, Paul, with stocks at all-time ridiculous highs, with inflation way above its target and rising, and it's printing anyway.
Yeah.
Reckless. Irresponsible.
Unbelievable. The only way I know to explain it, Chris, is, you know, money in our country has become a god. And what I mean by that is we think, you know, our leaders believe that if we just print enough money and give it to people, that's going to solve all their problems, right? Not changing your behavior, not looking at your life and how you can institute discipline, that you can set those real expectations. It's, oh no, we've got a problem, so let's give you some money to fix it. Let's not solve the core underlying problem that got us here. Let's just print money. You know, so there are people during times throughout history, and especially faith, those of us that have faith as our core tenet, if something goes wrong, you get on your knees and you ask God for guidance to give you the strength to walk through it. And trust that the Lord uses whatever calamity is cast upon you for your ultimate good and his glory down the road, right? But in our country, the only thing that they know to do is print money. And my biggest concern is they're caught up in the emotional weakness that we have as humans and hindsight bias that, hey, well, we printed all this money in 2008 and we didn't have a dollar collapse or an inflationary holocaust. So, yeah, it's a little bit harder this time, but it solved it in all of these periods. So let's just print a whole bunch more money and solve it at this moment in time. That's my biggest concern, is that seems to be the only thing that they know to do is just throw money at the problem. And let's cause these asset prices to go up. Theoretically, they'll continue to go up, and we're not going to have any negative consequences associated with that and tell us that it's temporary. That's my biggest concern. It doesn't make sense to be printing all of this money into this environment right here.
Well, every time they have printed, of course, they did a tiny baby version of this in 87 with the stock market crash, again in 94 with the corporate bond market hiccup, again in 1998 with the long-term capital management issue, again with the dot-com crisis, again, with the great financial crisis, and then, of course, super steroids. Well, actually, they didn't even stop. Let me back up. I mean, this annoyed me to no end. This is the great financial crisis. So they basically go from $880 billion to $2.4 trillion. They tripled the size of the Fed balance sheet. It took 100 years to get to this point, and then they just tripled it in, like, a couple months. And then things floated along, and then they did it again here in 2011, 12, and then they floated a little bit, and then the market started to not go up into the right. So, wow, they really printed up through 2014, 15. they never really stopped intervening in the markets. This is where they had to jump in with both feet, and they never got out of the pool. They tried for a little while, and then we had here the 2019 repo crisis, which caused them to also start printing, but then COVID.
Mm-hmm.
And then COVID, the COVID crisis is over. They still kept printing. It's just, it's just who they are and what they do. And what I want to point out is that at each one of these printings, Paul, the cut line for family income, where you're basically no longer can keep your nose above the water, just keeps moving up and up and up through the income stratas, right? And it's not uncommon to hear people now, Paul, earning $200,000 in a city saying, I'm barely making it. Why? Because of this.
And it's out there enough to people like Michael Green. He put together, gosh, I can't remember the name of the article now, My Life is a Lie.
Yeah.
And he was, just battered because of his work. But the core of his work is true. He basically established for a large part of America, $140,000 is the point which you have enough money left over to be able to save, and below that you don't. I mean, I've had a lot of conversations with young couples and conversations with, you know, kids of family of clients, and, you know, and I find that to be reality over large parts of the country. And then you've got your other cities to where, I mean, that's poverty level, right? They can't even live in some of these cities because of the cost of living in California, New York, and other Chicago and places like that.
No, and they don't care. That's what bothers me, Paul. It's not even, I'm not sure if they are hostile, but they're indifferent for sure, which is bad. But they're just indifferent to how many more people, you know, can no longer afford to live in the country that they're printing. And why do they print? Like, why is the Fed printing like it's an emergency right now? Well, if there is an emergency, they're not being honest about it and telling us what it is. I think you and I can explore this in terms of the private credit hiccups that are happening or some other things. But it's clear this is the Fed's like, oh, there's some sort of crisis out there. But the only crisis I can ever find in these moments, Paul, is there's some big bank that's about to lose some money, and that would be tragic. You know,
right.
And I want them to take their losses. I want them to have to lick their wounds. I want some of them to go out of business because they shouldn't be operating the way they've been operating. And then we'll carry on with better, healthier companies. But the Fed's job is to bail out the big banks whenever it looks like they're going to take a loss. That's what this is. This is them bailing somebody out. I just don't know who it is. It's not the American public, that's for sure.
But from behind the scenes, it looks like it could be very private equity, right? With what's taking place and what we're hearing about what is occurring within private equity, and it's behind a dark curtain. It's not clear where we can go in and see what's taking place, but there's credible analysts that are sharing all kinds of things that are taking place. That's the only thing that makes sense to me, is they're trying to protect those that are the most connected, that are donating the most to the politicians, and they're protecting their income source, it seems at this point, and their relationships by printing this money at the expense of the average American. I mean,
$172 billion is a shocking number.
It's a shocking number. It's shocking. And you know, and this is just a reminder, I get a little desensitized to it when I'm showing somebody in their retirement plan what the difference between 3.5% and 5.5% and 7.5% inflation. And one of the things I go through and say, hey, cumulatively over your retirement, this income level, I can't remember the numbers, you're going to need $3 million to sustain yourself. And from your investment portfolio, it's going to be three. That's it. You know, income, well, counting Social Security and all, I messed those numbers up. But the point is, I move them to 5.5, and that number jumps dramatically. And you move to 7.5, and people are like, oh my gosh, that's how bad inflation is? And I said, yes, if every American knew how bad the outcome of higher inflation is and the damage that puts and the pressure it puts on them in retirement, not counting while they're trying to save and earn enough to set aside for retirement, they would revolt against the government and we would not have any printing take place. But they don't show those numbers, right? They keep you short-term focused and say, hey, your balance sheet went up, your house went up. Okay, that's great. They don't point out the fact that, yeah, your taxes and insurance are going to go up following along behind that too. And your repairs are going to go up. And it just keeps people on this treadmill. The baby boomers have escaped from it at this point. But my concern is it's coming at them with a vengeance with the foundation we're laying right now. And the large majority are not prepared for it. Even those that that I've met that are in retirement, when I run this analysis on them, the large majority are not prepared for it. Nobody has told them or taken the time or even considered the risk out there to say, hey, you might not be able to change everything now to be prepared for this, but this is what's coming. So, and these are the things that you can do to try to head that off. And this is the line where you're going to have to make dramatic changes to protect yourself from it. And I just don't see how it doesn't come at this point, unless we absolutely have another deflationary Great Depression collapse that everything falls upon itself like a Jenga tower, to keep that from taking place. Because all of our actions, especially with the government leaders and printing and fiscal irresponsibility, is driving us in that direction.
Well, there's no chance in my mind that they are going to allow deflation to happen, because that could really implode the whole system. They would vastly prefer an inflationary explosion than a deflationary implosion, because you can't contain this once it starts happening. The whole system could be at fault. That's the great financial crisis. They already stared down the barrel of that gun and said, no thanks. So inflation problem. You know, when you are in an inflationary environment, what do you do as an investor? Well, you have to either accept the fact that you're going to have a steady erosion in your living standards, or you have to take a lot of risk on to try and stay ahead of that. So they're forcing people to either eat losses or take risks that are just outlandishly large, you know, and that's not a good choice to force people into. I just want people to be aware. That's the choice the Federal Reserve is saying. I'm going to either make you eat canned dog food, or you're going to have to risk it all on a hope for snake eyes at the table, you know, or something. It's just, it's really not a good situation. More people should be upset about it, to be honest, I think.
They just don't know. They don't understand, quite frankly, because there's really not anybody that's around today to, I mean, there are people that are around, but the most of the people that are alive and retired today heard about the inflation in the 1970s, and yeah, they had high mortgage rates, but they had the asset price inflation throughout their life to where that's kind of a memory in the past. That was somebody else. You know, if we had somebody that was 80 years old in 1960, or, you know, 75 years old in 1968, and lived through that inflation in their retirement that wasn't prepared for it, then that may be something that somebody would listen to, but we just don't have those individuals around right now because of how our life cycles go, right?
Yeah. By the way, I don't have the data, but we'll just bookmark it that there is a lot of cracks showing up in the housing market, which makes sense, right? They hit all-time record highs. Mm-hmm. In terms of affordability or unaffordability. So the Fed's response to whatever's going on is to print. The government's response is to borrow and spend. And so this orange line is just federal debt. It's total public debt. Interesting. When I went to the Fred site which is the Federal Reserve site at St. Louis, and I love the site. It gives me lots of good data and charts. I hadn't seen this before because I was like, wait a minute. It last updated March 3rd. Like, they issue the debt numbers daily at the Treasury. And they said next release date not available. Like, whoa, whoa, whoa. Why did the Federal Reserve stop recording the actual debt numbers? Because they were easy to find. I went, Paul, to the U.S. Treasury site and pulled it down. Okay, it's currently at $38.96 trillion, very close to $39 trillion. They're here at $38.5, and they stopped counting. I don't know why, but the last two times I've seen the Fed stop counting something, it was because they didn't want to. M3 comes to mind. They stopped counting how much money is in circulation across, how many dollars are in circulation across the world. I always get a little suspicious when this didn't make sense to me. Just.
No.
Anyway, $39 trillion, we'll call it. We'll round up. That's a little bizarre, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's bizarre. And I don't like that. I don't like this push to do away with quarterly earnings reports and reports from the government. That just doesn't make sense. Give people more information. You've got access to technology now where you can compile that data quicker. Give us more information. The only reason that you start hiding information is because you have something to hide, right? So that your propaganda and narrative will last a little bit longer and give you more time to build your next story when the data comes out. I don't like that. I don't understand in today's environment when we can compile this data so much faster that you're going to hide the data. It doesn't make sense.
Well, you know, we'll talk about super expensive stocks in a minute. But, you know, whenever the Fed prints like this, you know, obviously asset prices, financial asset prices tend to go up, right? Because that's the stimulus response. But there's kind of a stealth QE going on. We've mentioned it before. I just want to bring it up one more time, which is that right now, the cumulative interest expense for 2026 on the federal debt that's out there is up 7% higher than 2025. It's on track to, I don't know where it's going to end up, $1.24 trillion. And it could go higher from there. It might pick up speed. We don't know. But it's kind of like QE, Paul, because this is money. That's $1.24 trillion of cash that goes out into the system. And so that's, imagine, I mean, just comparing this to, say, 2020, when it was half that, less than half that. That's a lot of money. So that's out there working its magic, you know, has to go somewhere, right? So it's kind of, I think it plays, it definitely adds to overall liquidity. It's like it expands the money supply in essence.
It expands the money supply, which increases the likelihood of inflation, which further exacerbates, you know, the backdrop that we have, right? I mean, we're consistently seeing layoffs. At least the argument is AI, and that's less jobs, less earning for people with the cost of living going up. That's not good from an overall standpoint. At some point, that trickles into those corporate profits. It does,
yep.
Which trickles into a dramatically different market environment.
So to close this section out, more inflation's on the way. It's baked in the cake just because of the supply shocks that are happening. How would we get that double hump inflation? Well, it's going to be a combination of supply shocks that is going to be from energy as a first order, but second order effects like less wheat, less corn, less food, things like that. And then also we have Federal Reserve printing and federal government deficit spending on top of that. That's just inflation squared as far as I can tell, Paul. So that's kind of my thesis for why I say it's possible that inflation peaks out in a year or two or three, something unthinkable to most people today, which would be 18 to 20%.
That is unthinkable to the large majority of people, unfortunately.
Well, I don't. That's unthinkable to me. All right. So that concludes that section on inflation, but it dovetails into this next part, Paul. I want to talk about super-duper expensive equities, if we could. I had to put an extra superlative in there, super duper expensive, because this is, you and I have gone here before. Okay. We've talked about the Buffett indicator back when it was only 200%. So the Buffett indicator takes all the corporate equities and they have a value, and then it takes the entirety of the GDP and divides the first by the second and comes up with a number. So right now, corporate equities are 232% larger than the economy on which they are founded and from which they derive their earnings and incomes and all of that stuff. It's never been this high before. It hit 162% in 2000, right before that decline. Hit 218% right before the big decline we had in 2022, right? And here we are at 232%. Again, lots of printing, lots of liquidity, lots of things really driving that story. And some fundamental things too. Corporate earnings have been pretty robust. There is this AI thing, and people get, investors get a little starry-eyed. Tulips, railroads, .com, you know, houses. They do get a little excited by things. So AI is obviously a very shiny thing at this particular moment in time. It's powerful, but we've yet to see really what it's going to do for us in the long term.
No. And look, talking about the Buffett indicator being that expensive. So one thing about Buffett, I'll save this for another time. But the reality is every strategy that you invest with has its own set of strengths and weaknesses. And at some point in the cycle, it's going to struggle, right? That's the reason why investors tend to chase themes, retail investors do, and institutional and long-term investors, known investors like Buffett, are going to develop a strategy that they understand the strengths and weaknesses. They tend to be, especially Buffett, tends to be extremely immune from the fear of missing out, right? But the discipline that he has is what's so amazing to me and so encouraging that drives those of us to pay attention and follow the rules of your strategy, be disciplined, be patient. So I don't know how much cash that Buffett's sitting on right now, because I haven't looked at it here in the past month or two, but I know over the past 6 months, really, we've been talking about the fact that he has this massive hoard of treasuries that he's sitting on. And I found there was an interview here recently where he was just talking about how expensive the markets are. $350 billion,
last I heard, of cash.
Okay. Yeah. That's opportunity money. That's money that because of his indicators, he's not going to chase and he's not going to deploy this capital, right? The last time that he built a large cash position, nowhere near where it is right now, was in 1999 to the year 2000. And I remember television commentators making the comment, it's the new economy. Buffett has no clue what he's doing. One major news, financial commentator made the comment, he needs to step down and we need to get somebody else in there. He was shown right. He had capital available when the market went down, and a large majority of the positions that he had actually went up because investors were selling value stocks to go chase these high flyers. The same thing that we're seeing in this environment right now. And unfortunately, you know, to be a successful investor over time, there are times where you have to have discipline. There are times where you have to be patient, and there are times where you have to watch another strategy's strengths at their highest, day in the sun, and they're at that podium. But are you investing for the next 6 to 12 months, or are you investing for the next 10 to 15 years, right? Or 5 to 10 years? And his indicator has him in a position to where he's going to be able to capitalize on it when we revert back to the mean. And that thing's reverted severely over time.
Well, we can characterize that in a couple ways, and then I want to get to this incredible Paul Tudor Jones interview. The first thing we might notice is semiconductors. So semiconductors obviously powering the AI thing really hit a peak here at about 7% of total equity value in 2000, right? And before, they reverted back to their mean and hovered around 2%, and now they're cranking out at about 11%. Either it's this different this time, Paul, or it's not different this time. So far in my life, nothing's ever been different. When you buy expensive stocks, you're buying hope, and hope is a terrible strategy, and it really doesn't work when you're your hope is I'm going to buy these things that are super expensive and sell them to somebody else at a higher price later on. And by the way, this just came out. This was on April 27th, so a couple days ago. But the markets just printed on a 10-day return basis. They just printed the 100th percentile, meaning there has never been a stronger 10-day move in equities ever in all of history. Wars could have ended. Great advances could have been made. Great bear markets could have ended. Extraordinary things could have happened, but nothing has been as extraordinary for stocks as the 10 days prior to April 27th, which is just kind of silly to me. But this also is the kind of thing that a person who is most responsible for helping me understand how the world worked in terms of trading, equities, bubbles in particular. Michael, if you're listening, thank you. He said, no bubbles ever end without a blow off top. You have to have some last giant thrust to the surface that's just leaves everybody agog. For whatever reason, there's always that last burst.
Mm-hmm.
So I wonder, when you're seeing 100th percentile return in the context of the Iran war and all those other things, I kind of look at that and go, what is that we're looking at?
It sure looks like a blow off top. Those emotions take over. Fear of missing out takes over. And then that speculation feeds on top of itself. And then you have, individuals that are short that are forced to cover because those blow-offs, theoretically, if you're short, there's unlimited loss potential to the upside. So you have to cap those. So it starts out mechanical, emotions jump on top of, and we've seen retail just really pile all in this market more aggressively and more confident than they ever have in the past with no understanding of the risks that are under the surface.
That's absolutely true. So Paul Tudor Jones, legendary investor, obviously he's had a very long, very storied career. He's done exceedingly well as a fund manager. And so here he is on this show, and this is just really extraordinary. Let's listen in. I hope I have the volume set right, because he says so many extraordinary things here, Paul. I just want to have a chance to discuss them with you and everybody. Let's start here.
We're clearly so leveraged in equities in this country. We're so dependent upon firm equity prices at this point in time. And when I say leveraged, we're 252% of stock market cap to GDP. So 1929, we were, I think at the top, we were 65%. And then in 87, we got to about 85 or 90%. In 2000, we got to 170%. And now we're at 252. So you can just imagine, if you think about the periodicity of significant bear markets, since 1970, we get kind of a mean reversion about, on average, every 10 years. When I say mean reversion, let's say mean revert to the past 25 or 30-year PE. So if we did that here, that would be, and again, these are elevated PEs, way elevated beyond the 20th century. That would be a 30-35% decline. Well, 35% on 250% of GDP is 80-90% of GDP. The reverse wealth effect, oh my gosh. 10% of our tax revenues or capital gains, they go to zero. So you can see the budget deficit blowing up. You can see the bond market getting smoked. You can see this kind of negative self-reinforcing effect. And so it's troubling.
All right, so let's decode this a little bit there. So, because I just thought that was so important. He's just saying, look, when you're at 232% of GDP, and you just get a normal mean reversion, so we're going to take 30-35% of that number off the top. That's equivalent to removing 89% of GDP from the market, its value. Well, if the GDP, I'll just make a number up, is closing in on $30 trillion right now, you're talking like $25 trillion taken off of a market that's currently valued at about $75 trillion. So a minimum, you're just, this could get really, really ugly. I mean, if we get back to fair value, Paul, what are the numbers again?
Oh, it's devastating. I just pulled that chart up while he was going through that, and I'll show it in two different. I'll show it in the context of history, and then I'll show it in a little bit shorter term. I mean, that's a dramatic decline. And for the listeners out there, Paul Tudor Jones is a legend. He may not be a name that you guys have heard, but he's navigated well several cycles throughout history. So he is a legend. You have to listen when somebody like that speaks. So we've showed this before, but the black line is the S&P 500 going back to 1926. The red dotted line, the blue dotted line, and the green dotted line are price to earnings ratios. Okay, so in the 1970s, we dropped back. So last time really that we've seen an undervalued market is around 1984. So this is where we are today. Okay, so to reset to that level, and this is assuming the earnings stay up.
I mean, we're above the red line. The red line is overvalued, and we're way above it.
We're way above it. Just to get back to overvalued, right, is 4,681 on the S&P, and we're 7,121 today. That's a dramatic decline, approximately 35%. And notice, we've spent a lot of time at or under that line, right? Even back in 2022, we have pulled back to the top side of that line. So that's just a normal pullback at this point. Yeah, it's going to be more than 20%, but it wouldn't even be considered a bear market in reality. So what if we go down to this? So let's look at it on a little bit shorter term chart just to see here. And I know that listeners probably won't be able to
see. Oh, that's easier to see.
Yeah, they can see it here. But hang on, I want to show percent change. Now, you won't be able to see the percent because it's going to be small. But notice how we've been in this level, okay? So this is where we are, 7,121. I'm going to pull it back just to make the math easy. Just to get back to that level, that's a 35-36% decline, okay? If we go back to fair valued, which is 3,510 on the S&P, that's a 52% decline. And if we go all the way down to undervalued, again, this is assuming the earnings stay the same. That's a 68.2, let's just round it to 78% decline. Okay. But also 2022 or 2002, earnings dropped. 2008, they cratered. Okay. So if history matters, which I believe it does, and Paul Tudor's wisdom and warning is right, then at a minimum, if this gets out of control and we revert to the mean, you're going to see, you know, unless they can save it with printing. I mean, just in reality, this is hard to sound a 70% decline. And if earnings collapse and we get back to like we did in the 70s, because it's washed this euphoria out of the market, you know, it's not outside the realm of possibility to see Great Depression type declines outside of, you know, them just deciding to print us into hyperinflation. That's assuming they can, because if AI takes over all the jobs, where's the earnings going to come through unless we have just universal basic income? And you better prepare yourself ahead of time to make sure that you're okay if that comes along, because it's going to be equal misery for all people except for those that are in the halls of power.
Well, I think that this begins to explain some of the panic printing that we're seeing at the Fed. Because they know that what Paul is talking about is a real thing. They don't even want to begin to entertain the idea of what would mean reversion look like. They have to prevent that from even getting a toehold. But I'm not sure what they can really do about it at this point because of how stretched and extended. They're going to have to really, really print. And then they're going to have to explain why somebody earning $250,000 a year is barely scraping by. And then $300,000, and then $400,000. Like, they're just going to chew through. Inflation will destroy everything at some point. Right. So that's the balancing act. Let's carry on. Let's see what else he has to say here.
Clearly in the sovereign debt bubble, in the stock market, we're over equitized as a country. I have the highest individual equity weightings in the history of the country. And then the real problem is if you look at private equity in 2007, 2008, that was about 7% of institutional portfolios. Now it's about 16% of the institutional portfolios. Real estate's gone up. Infrastructure bets have gone up. We're so much more liquid than we were in 2008. So you have to be cognizant of that fact when you think about how you have your money deployed. I had a friend ask me, he said, if you were investing for 20 years, what would you tell somebody? And because he knows that I'm supposed to say, you just buy the S&P, close your eyes. Well, the problem is that if you buy the S&P at this current valuation, the 10-year forward returns negative when you buy with the S&P PE of 22. That's what history shows. So, yes, the S&P is a spectacular long-term, if you have a 100-year view, but that's because that's an average of 100 years, including times when the S&P 500 PE was 6 and 7 and 8, or one-third of what it is right now. So valuation matters a lot, and the stock market's really high, and it's going to be really hard to make money from here.
There you have it. It's going to be really hard to make money from here. You and I have talked about this at great length, that the 10-year expected forward returns when you have super-duper expensive equities historically hasn't been good. And so it's against that backdrop we have to start to entertain this idea. Well, it's different now because we've had this PE expansion because the Federal Reserve monkeyed with interest rates, gave us the ZERP zero interest rate policy, which therefore goosed the stock market returns and people got used to it. And they now expect that the Fed's always going to bail them out and always make stocks go higher, higher and higher. It's an unusual bet to make because things don't work that way. Here's my theory, Paul. If it was possible to print your way to prosperity, the Romans would have figured it out because we're still using some of their roads and aqueducts, and we haven't figured out how they made that cement that sets up in salt water. They tried it. They couldn't work it out. If the Romans couldn't figure out how to debase currency and have that be a durable prosperity outcome, I bet we can't do it either. Just as a guess.
Right. Well, I mean, it's been tried and tried again throughout history, and that's why societies ultimately have come back to gold. That's why Satoshi, forget all the questions about who that is, developed Bitcoin as the cryptocurrency with a limited expansion rate, right? So that you have some expansion in there, but the reality is you don't have this just ability to print from a political standpoint to try to bail us out of our problems, because in all of history, it has ended poorly. It's not ended well. You know, and he talked about, you know, one thing, I don't know if this is the right time to kind of point out, I guess it is, but he talked about the fact that equities would go sideways for some time, right? Like best case scenario in 20 years, over 100 years it has worked. But the problem is when you go back through all of these periods of time through history, where where the markets have been expensive, what has happened, right? There's all kinds of people going to say that this can't occur. The Great Depression can't occur. But I just want to point it out, okay? Because back then, I don't have the price-to-earnings ratio overlay. So the reality is 1929 was the most expensive market that we had, okay? So yes, it got back to even, but it took 25 years to get back to even here, okay? It was 1955 before it did. So what happens if you're 65 and you retire at that point, right? And you're taking income distributions off of your portfolio because, you know, you believe that passive is going to work and you're overweight equities. That's one thing that he talks about in all of history. We have more equity allocation than we ever have in the history of the country. So that means there's more assets that are going to be forced to be liquidated, or you're going to have to go back to work at 65 if you're not prepared for it. That was an 86% decline to the bottom. We had a big bounce on the other side, and a lot of people don't realize we had another 52% decline, had a little bit of a bounce, but from 1937 into 1942, you had another 59% decline. And then finally, we bottomed and worked up that direction. So, yeah, that was, you know, 25 years of flat. That's going to wipe out the large majority of baby boomers if they're passively investing, and we do have something like that, okay? But that was a deflationary environment. So let's go take a look at another one. And I'm going to, bear with me, I'm going to scroll down here before I get to it because this is a better chart. So this is 1960 to 1984, okay? So we're coming out of that major bull market. Again, I don't have the overlay, but the reality is, do I have it above? Let me look at it and see here. So, yeah, so 1974, just to reference that, the market was expensive. Remember, that red dotted line is a price-to-earnings ratio of 20, so we're expensive. So we get back down to here, okay? So you have this massive decline in the midst of the backdrop of all the inflation that was occurring in the 1970s, and it was 10 years before it got back to even. Okay, but we got to an undervalued market at the time. But look at the volatility and the warnings you had leading up to that. From 1973 down to the bottom in 1974, that took you back 13 years to those balances in 1963. So if you're in a position where you're forced to sell or you panic sell at that point because, you know, you don't really understand, you don't think that that can happen, that's something that can do dramatic damage to investors. And then again, another historical period, 2000 to 2014 is the chart here. You had the approximately 47% decline in the year 2000, got back to even. You dropped 52.8% based on the chart here. And it was 13 years before you got back to even. So if you're 65 in this environment right here, and you have no downside risk management, you're over equities, overweighted equities, you're forced either to go back to work, dramatically reduce your lifestyle in retirement, or use your capital up. That's the choices and the emotions that people are going to face during periods of time like that. That's the benefit that I have in all of these years of working with people is, you know, our strategy, by God's grace, did a phenomenal job of sidestepping 2008. It wasn't easy getting defensive leading up to it because there was all kinds of fear of missing out at that time as well. You know, we were being told by our leaders that everything was going to be okay, subprimes contained, you know, and people were questioning, hey, you're telling me that we've got some potential calamity coming. You've invested our portfolios to be very conservative, and we feel like we're missing all this opportunity because they're telling us it's going to be okay. On the other side of it, in 2008, 2009, you had all kinds of people that were coming in. It's like, hey, I just got absolutely wiped out in my investment portfolios. What do I do? And about the time we're maneuvering back to a buy signal, I'm like, look, at this point, you're at the worst part of a passive strategy. The worst thing you can do is liquidate at this point. You've got to hold on a little bit longer. The sheer amount of stress that calls people in retirement, even when I'm trying to coach them in that direction, you know, and then at that time, even the prior advisors they had are like, yeah, we got to lower your risk at this point, update your questionnaire. You went from aggressive investor to a conservative investor, right? It was just a horrible environment for people to have to navigate, and it made the retirements miserable for so many people. Now, they printed us out of that one last time. It should have taken a lot longer. We should have taken our chance to let the system recover itself, build a good foundation, but they didn't. That's why I say we have to play by the rules that are forced upon us at this point, because they printed us again into this environment to where the likelihood of a calamity occurring is much greater and potentially much worse than anything that I've referenced there outside of 1929. And the question is, can you print us out of that circumstance? Maybe you can, but there's a good chance that it causes a currency crisis at some point in the future. I'm not saying imminently, but on the other side of that, and then that in itself is a whole nother problem. So I'm still of the belief that we're going to get a deflationary impulse, and then we're going to have a inflationary holocaust on the other side of that.
I would agree with that. And the one overlay I want to put on top of your other overlays is that in each of those periods from 29 to 54 and all of those other periods you mentioned, energy was getting cheaper and more abundant through every one of those periods, mm-hmm. right? Because we were discovering new ways to get oil out of the ground, all that. This is a different environment. So what we're really saying, what is the stock market a representation of? It's the prosperity of a nation. So great. Our nation has become more and more and more prosperous. The thing sitting under that most people aren't aware of, Paul, is energy. Is if you have that energy there, great. So the United States is currently an energy powerhouse, but it's very important to recognize where we are in that cycle. And the shale oils are now just starting to do the rollover part. And, you know, there's obviously these other things going on in the world. So an energy shock, particularly a supply shock in energy, is a kind of a brand new beast in the story, whereas you could print over the other stuff. Those were kind of human errors, right? Those were, we fumbled those balls, right? You know, the credit blowups of 2008, the overdoing it in 2000, et cetera. So you could, I can see how you can paper over those things. Still, it took time. The papering wasn't instant. It took 5, 10, 15, 20 years, depending on the era, but this time we can't print our way past an energy shock. We just can't. It's a totally different beast. And I don't know that anybody in power is aware of that at this point in time. I'm not sure they've taken the time to familiarize themselves with the concept.
You know, hubris and arrogance blinds you to potential outcomes that are a risk because you believe that you're bulletproof. And that's my biggest concern, is there's a level of arrogance and hubris within the halls of power that naturally causes them to overlook any consideration of something that could take us down.
Mm-hmm.
So I am concerned about that. And one last thing, not to beat this to death, but I want to share Japan, because we've even got a recent example of something that is much more severe than what I showed in the past, right? If you were a Japanese investor, you were euphoric in the 1980s, right? 378% from the breakout that occurred in 1983. It peaked in late 1989, 90, let's just say 1990, and declined all the way into 2008, 34 years that it went sideways, okay? Now, if you were a Japanese investor and you had an adaptive strategy, then you could have redeployed some of that capital into other parts of the world that were underpriced and passed that baton off to protect yourself. That's why I believe in a tactical investment strategy that's adaptive. And that's why we implement, because, yeah, U.S. equity markets are ridiculously overvalued. Commodities in general are not. They're pretty much at the same levels that they've been back in 2008. They spent all this time going sideways. Emerging markets are of some of the most attractive value that's out there. And if commodity goes up, there's a lot of emerging markets that benefit from those commodity cycles. So I'm not terrified of the outcome. I'm heartbroken over if it's not different this time. And the U.S. experience is something that Japanese investors did after 1989. It's, you know, everything's going to change, but it's going to be too late for those individuals that are fully convinced that passive is the way to go and can't consider any other alternative because of the fact it's not going to make those adaptations. If you have strategies that can help you redirect those assets into those other categories that are undervalued, or you're a long-term fundamental investor where you're seeking out those opportunities, there are places that will benefit. So it's not all dark days in the future, but it may be dark days for you know, the S&P 500 as it is, give a completely different outcome in the future than what most people are expecting it to deliver.
Well, it's not different this time. I'm going to go out on a limb and say that. And a big part of this, Paul, so to summarize, yes, equities are super duper expensive, or 232%. Obviously, anybody who's been around the block a couple times, warning bells are going off. Warren Buffett, Paul Tudor Jones, us. So not to put us in the same categories, but, you know, of an age.
I was about to say.
You know, however.
Druckenmiller.
Yep. However, the thing that could be a pin in all of that, of course, is if interest rates spike for some reason, get out of control. You showed that trend line in the 30-year. We're now over it. We're headed in a different direction. We've seen recently the long bonds of most Western countries have been going up, not down, you know, which is kind of a weird thing in a crisis environment. So next I want to turn to this next piece, which is this idea, Paul, which is that there is potentially a looming credit crunch coming in. I can't wait to get your point of view on these. We have some big people saying some things, and I think we need to sit up and listen carefully because of who's saying them. And, you know, this gives me a chance to break out my old 2008 slide. I love this one. Credit crunch. Now with sugar-coated derivatives, it says hedge funds, free helicopter inside with Ben Bernanke on the cover. And it begins here. So Hank Paulson was Treasury Secretary during the Great Financial Crisis, and he came from Goldman Sachs. And here he is saying some stuff on Wall Street Week that's just, tell me what you think he's saying.
This crisis is different, right? If when you hit the wall and you're trying to issue treasuries and the Fed is the only buyer and the prices of the treasuries are going down and interest rates are up, that's a dangerous thing. And so the thing I am talking about now is we know, people say, when are you going to hit the wall? I obviously don't know. It's impossible to know. But the law of economic gravity, you're not going to know that. So, and when we hit it, it will be vicious. So we have to prepare for that eventuality. And I think we need an emergency break the glass plan, which is targeted and short term on the shelf. So it's ready to go when we hit the wall.
So he's saying when we hit the wall and it's a treasury wall, so we'll run out of buyers for some reason, right? I don't know, maybe China no longer wants our treasury bonds for some unknown reason, or there's just too many for the market to absorb, or maybe the Gulf states need money for reconstruction and they start selling, whatever it is, you know, he's saying he doesn't say if. Three times he says when we hit the wall.
Right.
Now, a guy like that of his stature doesn't just come out and drop a, that's a pretty urgent warning, I think, from a guy of his stature. How do you interpret it?
That's a warning. You can tell. And he didn't mince words at all. He said when. I mean, it's just a mathematical inevitability. He also acknowledges we don't know exactly when you reach that breaking point, right? But you know that it's coming. And he talks about when you hit that wall, you can't ignore those consequences. Not the words that he used, but what I'm, my interpretation of what he said. And he's also saying that we have to have something ready now to prepare for it ahead of time, so that you can deal quicker and maneuver quicker, so that you can hopefully mitigate that outcome, right? Tap the brakes as best you can instead of just hitting that wall at full speed. So that's a major warning from somebody that knows the system, understands where we are, and knows that we're running out of space on the runway.
Well, he's saying, too, we want to put a plan on the shelf, put it behind glass, but if we get to that break-the-glass moment, we have something, we know what to do. My understanding of how they in this story operate, you know, the authorities, they do what's worked before. So for the Fed, that's printing, right?
Right.
And for the government, it's going to be some TARP, TELF plan and some acronym that basically is tons of future taxpayer money spent today so that something bad doesn't happen in the financial system. We have all these now absolutely enshrined this idea that there are too big to fail entities, institutions, banks. You know, so if something shows up in one of those areas, I think what Hank is saying is like, we should be ready for that because it's coming and we should know what to do. Right. So making a pitch for developing a plan beforehand. But the plan, Paul, spoiler alert, it's going to involve printing money.
Yeah. Yield curve control, printing money. You know, my greatest concern would be, and I'm not saying this is the case, there's all kinds of people that have made poor tax decisions, you know, because there's the argument the Democrats are going to force you all in the Treasury. That scares the fool out of the Republicans. There's the argument that the Republicans will force you 401k all in the Treasury. I think the end result is they got a lot of people to cash money out to get tax revenue in the short run. So just with that being said, but, you know, what are they going to do? Are the yield curve control? They're going to print a bunch of money to buy, and then they're going to force people to own Treasuries with a certain percentage in some manner. I don't know. You know, I don't know. I'd love to know what his ideas for the solutions are so that we could better prepare.
I'm a little worried it's this stablecoin idea that they keep shoving while all this other stuff is happening. Because remember, stablecoins are supposed to be backed one-to-one by treasuries. Maybe that provides some buying pressure, as it were, for those things. But, Well, adding to that, this just came to me this morning. Jamie Dimon, of course, the CEO of JP Morgan, today said, the way it's going now, there will be some kind of bond crisis. He added that when a credit recession hits across all lending, it will be worse than people think. It might be terrible. End quote. So he says, will be some kind of bond crisis. It's going to be worse than people think. In fact, it might be terrible. So, and this isn't just related to treasuries. This is a broader, this is a bond crisis. So this is a credit crisis that he's talking about. Again, fairly hyperbolic words from a man who's normally very kind of sedate in his phrasing, euphemistic. He's cautious.
He is.
Why are they using terms like this all of a sudden?
Well, my assumption would be is he sees the handwriting on the wall. He can see the inevitable outcome if we don't change the path that we're on right now. Because you got to think, CEO of JP Morgan, he has a better insight into the credit markets, the ability of borrowers to pay their debt. You know, he's seeing all kinds of metrics that are out there. And if he's recognizing that we're at the point that it might be terrible and that it is coming to an end, he knows that more than anybody else that's out there right now. I mean, he just does. So that's a warning that should, another one from a legend in his industry, like him or not, where he is, he's at the pinnacle of his industry, and he's putting warnings out there. Maybe that's another reason we're seeing so many insiders that are selling right now, just dramatic numbers of insiders that are selling into this incredible equity move that we've seen. That's different behavior. That's the type of behavior you see at a market top when the people who know and see the data before anybody else are putting these warnings out. And that not only are they putting warnings out, I don't know if JB Diamond sold, okay, so don't track it there. I'm sure we could go look and see, but the reality is they're putting these warnings out and the insiders are selling into this market strength. That's just more evidence that stacks that we're closer to the end of this runway than the markets obviously realize in general at this point.
Well, and if I remember correctly, Paul Tudor Jones in his interview said that in 2008, private credit and equity was about 6%. And now it's up to 17%. And he said that we're more illiquid than in 2008. And of course, illiquidity was a big problem in 2008. Hey, Paul, I have these, you know, dog meat CLOs over here. I'd like to sell them to you. And you're like, there's no liquidity for that. So, but we're starting to see this, right? So maybe now we can get to this. This came out on April 22nd. So it's official. Thoma Bravo handing the keys to creditors, $5.1 billion in equity. Wiped out. This is the 2021 software vintage in one deal. Zero interest rates, maximum leverage, sub 30% loan to value. What happened to the cushion? Boom. They handed that over. And this, Jack Farley is saying this may be the largest private credit default ever, to which I would say so far. And Blackstone has a public BDC, third largest in the world, owns Medallia loans in a massive way, nearly $400 million, which comprises 5% of net assets. If that gets marked to zero, that could be pretty bad. And these BDCs are private development companies, are now collectively, and those are companies that lend directly to private and mid-sized companies, private. They're trading at a 15% discount to book, which means that what they say they're worth and how they're being valued, there's a widening gap showing up in there. These are big numbers. Could they be talking about, in part, they must be talking about this. They have better insight. Like Jamie Dimon knows exactly what's happening with this stuff, don't you think?
I don't know for sure. Well, I'm sure they're involved in private equity clearly. So, yeah, they know what's going on under the surface. And if you're putting, you know, that's something that people should listen to instead of throwing a whole bunch of numbers out there. But just a statement like that is a warning and a shot across the bow to say, hey, pay attention, prepare yourself. And look, even in the best of times, right, like the problem with even real estate investment trusts over time, you know, these things are, everything looks good on paper when they print them. But I mean, I've had a client come in, I guess it was probably about 7 years ago, that had a legacy real estate investment trust that, you know, they put their name on the list to get out for quite some time. I think they bought it around 2014. They stopped paying dividends in 2019. So it's just a dead asset in there that's got that's not producing any income. They can't find an exit. And, you know, they're just locked up. That's what illiquidity is. And we're seeing these gates close where investors can't take distributions out of these private equity funds. And markets are at all-time highs, right? So what happens if the markets crack? What happens if oil spikes and further exacerbates this situation? It's just going to get worse. It's just going to get worse. And we've already got the largest bankruptcy in history. And markets are at all-time highs, right? Nobody's paying attention to the risks that are under the surface.
It seems not, but so I think maybe this is why the Fed has printed $179 billion so far in the first 4 months of this year. I think it explains there's just been walls of liquidity that have been coming into the market from somewhere. And I think it seems designed to sort of keep everything propped up. But what you noted before is really important. Insiders have been taking that opportunity in fairly large numbers to treat that as exit liquidity, sell their shares as insiders, not buy their own shares, demonstrating more confidence, really using it to pull money out of the system while they can. And I do think it's unfortunate mm-hmm. that people get caught up in this. And if this is truly the end of a bubble era, and so this is the last blow off top that happens, and people get sucked in and FOMO, you know, fear of missing out, and just sort of feeds on itself. But at some point, you know, these things can quickly reverse. And I can say that, Paul, because this won't be my first bubble bursting, sad to say. This will be my third. So seen it before.
No, and all the evidence is here, right? Wall Street moves in advance. When you're dealing with big money, you have to move slowly over time because you can't just dump on the market and impact prices and those investors that are in that fund or yourself. So we've seen a push. You know, the amount of money that you had to get into private equity was way up here, and then that drives all the way down to the ultimate culmination where Trump's like, hey, we're going to offer private equity into 401ks. And I think it's a disastrous idea. And then, you know, and then all of this propaganda, it's like just huge amounts of propaganda marketing to individual retail investors that creates that euphoria and that demand that they're caught up in fear of missing out. They're already struggling, right? Inflation's putting pressure on them, and they need an exit. And the exit is basically a lottery ticket mentality. And along those lines, I thought it was fascinating. Charlie Bolello posted on April 27th. I thought this was a fascinating statistic. Americans spent over $109 billion on lottery tickets last year, which is more than they spent on movies, books, concerts, and sport tickets combined. I mean, that's just a mile marker that shows the desperation and if I just win the lottery, it'll solve my problems. I believe that you've got investors that are so caught up in this marketing and propaganda and push to provide liquidity for the bigger investors that are out there, that's what creates this euphoric move, right? And I get calls from time to time, and they rarely get through because I never answer the phone at the office because you got all kinds of people that are calling and marketing. But I happened to pick up the phone one day. I thought it was a client that they had sent to me, and this guy, he starts pitching to me. He's like, hey, this is great stock, and you need to buy this and recommend it to your clients. And I'm like, oh, really? So who's trying to sell this? And he never answered my question. I said, who are you working for? Are you working for a big hedge fund? Are you working for private equity? What are you working for? Because why in the world are you calling me pushing a stock, right? I've got my research process. And the guy just hangs up on me. He's like, I'll move on to somebody else. But I mean, they do it to retail investors through email marketing, social media campaigns. They do it to advisors like myself. They'll call and, you know, paint this great picture that you think, oh, I'm going to hold on to, you know, I'm going to do great for these clients. And you just can't get caught up in that. You got to keep your emotions in check and work your plan. But emotions are hard. They're hard for a lot of people to keep in check. Because especially you look in the rearview mirror, if I'd have just bought private equity back then and had those type of returns and you mentally projected in the future, but the average investor doesn't understand the math behind what made it attractive back then. They don't realize the fact that you had to have $1 million minimum or a net worth a whole lot larger than that to be able to participate in it. And now that the large majority of the returns have been garnered and beyond where the valuation should be, now all of a sudden it's getting marketed to you very heavily. And it's just hard, especially with the constant onslaught of pictures of a bright future. And what I like to go back to is I don't want to listen to what people are saying. I want to watch what they're doing, right? If what they're saying and what they're doing are in alignment, then they're trustworthy. But when I look at what insiders are doing, right, and they're selling for whatever reason, you know, maybe it doesn't have to do with what they're seeing under the surface of the market. That's a potential. Maybe they just all happen to be at that point in their life where they're taking some chips off the table. I'd get that if it was a few, but when you're looking at 90%+ of on a weekly basis of the insider transactions being sells, I don't know, don't hold me to that statistic. It's just a large number. I'm going off the picture, green versus red. The large majority are sells. What they're doing tells me that at least across the board in multiple industries, they're seeing a future right now that tells them that they need to take some profits off the table and prepare themselves for something, right?
Indeed. Paul, we're going to leave it there for today. And so for anybody who wants to talk with Paul and his amazing team, please just go to peakfinancialinvesting.com, fill out a simple form, and somebody from Paul's office will be back in touch with you within 48 business hours. And you can start the first of three phone calls, an introductory call, a planning call, and then finally a recommendations call. It goes that far. And if all that checks out and you want to work together, then that's the process to become part of Paul's family universe of people that he helps and treats just like family. So with that, Paul, thanks so much for your time today.
It's my honor. Good to see you, Chris.
Bye, everyone. Until next week, signing off for now.